Welcome back to Human Emotion. So we know that emotions are inherently social, but what do we actually know about emotions in a social world? How do emotions look in our everyday social exchanges, and how do they underlie, shape, and change some of our most vital social bonds with other people? So these are some of the questions that we're going to continue to really probe and examine today. And then today, we'll be focusing on emotions in a social world, part 3, and in particular, delving into the realm of relationships. And I'm particularly excited today to have a very special guest lecturer on this topic, Professor Margaret Clark. So as we get into this topic today, we'll start with our special guest lecture, followed by our takeaway questions and expert interview. So I'm very, very delighted to now be starting with our guest lecture. Today we'll be having Dr. Margaret Clark, a professor of psychology at Yale University, speaking with us today on how the relational context shapes our emotional lives. So welcome, Margaret. Thank you for being here today.
Okay, what I want to talk about is how relational context shapes our emotional lives. From my point of view, as someone who studies relationships, I'm often struck by how often we focus on emotions as individual affairs. We know a lot about how people express emotion on their face, what the physiological concomitants of emotion are. We know a lot about how individuals try to regulate their own emotions. And we actually, less often than I think is ideal, think about emotions in social context. But emotions aren't entirely internal affairs. We feel our emotions, and we use that information to regulate our behavior. But emotions show on our faces. You can hear them in our voices. They show in our postures. And in fact, we often express what we're feeling to other people. We tell other people that we're sad or happy or angry. They communicate something about us to other people. And the fact that emotions show allows them to serve several social functions. I'm going to mention just a few, but talk primarily about one. So one function that emotions serve socially is called social referencing. People often look at other people in social situations to determine how they should feel in that social situation. If we walk into a room and someone looks scared to death, we may use that to think about what we should feel. If they're scared to death, something's going on, maybe we should be scared to death too. So social referencing is one function that emotions serve. Another is social protection. If someone comes toward us, they're walking toward us and they're smiling, that's a pretty good sign that the situation is safe. They're friendly. We can interact with them. It's probably a good idea to interact with them. If, on the other hand, they're very angry and they're coming at us, it might be a good idea to get out of the situation. So those are two kinds of social functions, but they're not the ones I'm going to really focus on today. A third function they serve is actually to help us take care of other people's needs. Emotions very often convey information about the person's needs who's expressing that emotion. So if a person's fearful, they may need help in getting out of a situation or taking care of, getting rid of whatever's causing them fear. If they're happy, that actually also signals some information about them that's important. If they're happy, that signals to us that maybe they're enjoying how we're interacting with them. Maybe they like being with us. We should continue. If they're happy and sitting alone doing something, maybe we shouldn't bother them at all. They're perfectly fine all by themselves. So I'm particularly interested in how emotions signal our needs to other people. And that's what I want to talk about today. So our relational context shapes how we react to other people's emotions, whether we respond to them with support or whether we'd rather not give them support when they express emotion. I think we all intuitively know this, although there's very few studies on them. So consider a parent interacting with a child. This is actually a picture of my nephew interacting with his 2-year-old child. So it's fine for a 2-year-old to express any emotion he feels like to his parent. In fact, it's very important that the child does this, especially before they're able to talk. If a baby cries, for instance, the parent figures out, that's a cue that the parent should figure out what's wrong and do something about it. They should take care of that child's needs. If a child giggles and laughs when the parent is reading a book to them, that is a pretty powerful signal that whatever he's reading appeals to the child and he should keep reading. So in a parent-child relationship, the child should be expressing emotion to the parent. The parent should be responding to that emotion. But what about the parent? The situation is entirely different to the parent. What if the parent happened to lose his job and is very upset? That parent should not express, I think we all know this, this parent should not express that emotion to the child. Why? Because that child can't assume responsibility for taking care of the parent. And so it's actually inappropriate for the parent to express emotion to the child. What about friends? Here's a picture of me sitting with some of my friends. Friends have a more equal relationship. They're often responsive to one another's needs, and it's totally appropriate for friends to express emotion to each other, and they often do it, and the person to whom you express the emotion often responds with care. So we don't have to suppress our emotion with friends. On the other hand, what if we're in a business setting and we're with business partners? Here I think we all intuitively know that it's not terribly appropriate to express lots of emotion. Why is that? I think we don't think about it much, but I think the reason is that business partners are not responsible for the other person's needs. They're engaging in business because they care about their own needs. They have what we call an exchange relationships with one another, and you really don't want someone with whom you're doing business expressing like lots of sadness about what happened at home, because you're really not responsible for that. So I think we intuitively know relationships make a lot of difference. Now, long ago, along with Judson Mills, I distinguished between two types of relationships. And more recently, I've emphasized a quantitative dimension of one of them. So the two types of relationships we talked about were exchange relationships and communal relationships. In exchange relationships, you don't feel any special responsibility for the other person's needs. You do exchange benefits, but you give benefits to the other person with the expectation of receiving something in return. And when you accept a benefit, you expect to repay the other person. You have no special responsibility for their needs. On the other hand, in communal relationships, you do feel a special responsibility for partners. Communal relationships are often exemplified by friendships, parent-child relationships, romantic relationships. In these relationships, you give benefits to support the other person's welfare, to promote the other person's welfare, and you do it non-contingently. Now, an important point about communal relationships is that there is a quantitative dimension to them. We don't assume an equal degree of responsibility for all our communal partners' needs. And I'm going to show that on the next slide. What I have here, I'm going to switch perspectives a little bit. And I want you to consider the responsibility that others assume for our welfare first. So what I have here is something called communal strength. And this is communal strength in terms of what we expect from a partner. We don't expect much from an infant. An infant has very little ability, no ability really, to take care of our needs. And so we don't